Welcome to the Razor's Ink podcast with your host, Jonathan Farini. Over the last 50 years, there have been many films with capital punishment as a plot element, from 12 Angry Men to Monsters Ball, but fewer films where the death penalty is the central theme, let alone based on a very true story, and even fewer still where the incarcerated is a woman. So what if I told you that this rare depiction of a woman on death row came out nearly 70 years ago? Pour yourself a drink, pull up a chair, and hear Jonathan's take on movies, television, and today, another overlooked film in which the themes still resonate today. Here's your host, Jonathan Farini.
At the time of this recording, I heard news that a condemned man was executed by firing squad. Which films do you think of about the death penalty? Dead Man Walking, A Man is Condemned to Death, 1995. Susan Sarandon won the Oscar for Best Actress. The Green Mile, A Man is Condemned to Death, 1999. Can you think of a film about a woman condemned to death? The answer is the 1958 movie I Want to Live, starring Susan Hayward, playing Barbara Graham, who was a cause celeb and mother put to death at age 31 in California's San Quentin gas chamber in 1955. Susan won the Oscar for Best Actress in 1959 for this performance. You've heard of the military-industrial complex, but I contend there is a criminal justice media complex, which was at work within this story and plays out even today. To understand my terminology, ask yourself if you believe justice is blind, and does money, or the lack of money, influence outcomes in criminal trials? Do you believe media attention for or against a defendant may determine guilt or innocence? My answer is yes to both questions, and my criminal justice media complex, which I'll call the machine, as we move forward, is a protagonist inside I Want to Live. In this movie, the media was newspaper sales, and to a lesser extent, television coverage just coming into its own in the 50s. Today, there's a huge television market for true crime programming, permitting viewers into the crime scenes, courthouses, and jail cells, while inviting viewers to be voyeurs to the savagery or becoming amateur sleuths. Viewership means ratings, fat ad sales, and revenue for the networks. The more hideous and notorious the crime, the greater the viewing audience. As I discuss I Want to Live, ask yourself if this same trial were taking place today. What would be the media attention, viewership, ad sales, and revenues? Hint, it would be huge. I Want to Live was released through United Artists in 1958. It's about a woman named Barbara Graham, who was described in newspaper print as a, quote, good time girl, unquote. Imagine the effect of that media attention on any woman's access to justice.
Ever been arrested?
No.
Hey, what is this, a striptease?
Whom do you wish notified in case of death or serious illness?
Marlon Brando.
She was a tough, sexy, and defiant woman who preferred a life on the edge, working as a prostitute and bad check passer. It shouldn't come as a surprise she was the product of a bad childhood. Remember defiance as I move through this analysis, because it's a metaphor for both her wrong choices leading to her fate and a gallant but failed battle against the machine. Barbara was a tiger, symbolized by a stuffed toy tiger she gifted to her baby son, Bobby. The media component of the machine presents itself early in the movie. Before the first frames of the movie comes a still frame disclaimer, reading,
"You're about to see a factual story. It is based on articles I wrote, other newspaper and magazine articles, court records, legal and private correspondence, investigative reports, personal interviews, and the letter of Barbara Graham, signed Edgar S. Montgomery, Pulitzer Prize winner, San Francisco Examiner.
Remember this, because it will appear again at the conclusion of the movie and likely have more significance for you. Although newspapers comprised the media at this time, television news was coming into its own. George Putnam, who plays himself, an L.A. television anchor, a Law and Order type, with a moniker, one reporter's opinion.
You're a cinch to be cyanide.
Those are the words which go echoing through the courtroom today at the trial of Barbara Graham. A written transcript is used in court for the prosecution. But you are hearing the actual voices as originally recorded on the wire inside a tiny minifone like this, which police officer Miranda conceals on his body during his rigged prison meeting with the alleged murderess.
Shows up throughout the film with what appears to be a bias towards Barbara. Nelson Gidding and Don Mankiewicz wrote the screenplay, adapted from personal letters written by Graham and newspaper articles written by Ed Montgomery. Directed by Robert Wise, a prolific director with a filmography too long to mention here, but here's a sampling. The Sound of Music, Oscar Best Director, Oscar Best Picture, 1966. West Side Story, Oscar Best Picture, Oscar Best Director, 1962. The Sand Pebbles, Star Trek, to name a few. When the opening titles to a movie impress you, you're likely in for a good movie. See my podcast about titles. Here, you're treated to simple white fonts against a black canvas with the coolest jazz score arranged by Johnny Mandel. There's no doubt we're inside that fabulous 50s beatnik jazz club, cigarette booze, and reefer madness time period. I was born in 1958, the same year the movie was released, so it's a treat to see what life looked like, including exteriors of San Francisco and Hollywood of the time period. I'll weave my criminal justice media complex theory, or the machine, inside the plot which follows. We first meet Hayward's petty criminal and prostitute, Barbara Graham, in San Francisco, facing a misdemeanor charge for soliciting sex. The judicial component of the machine shows up when a cop follows her into her hotel room and threatens to arrest her and the John for a federal Mann Act charge, meaning transporting women across state lines for moral turpitude. It's a felony. Barbara cuts the John and herself a break by admitting she rented the room, making the bust only a misdemeanor. Barbara is later charged with perjury, after she provides two criminal friends a false alibi. She's released from a short prison stay at Corona State Women's Prison with a 5-year probation. She's admonished upon release by a motherly matron played by Olive Blakenly.
I see 1 Section K juvenile morals, 4 vagrancy, 1 vagrancy quarantine, 3 soliciting, perjury, not to mention the 2 years you spent at the Ventura Reform School for girls.
As long as you're adding up the score, my mother was in Ventura before me. That ought to be worth extra points.
What I'm trying to say is you do have a choice. People have managed to be fairly happy by not getting into trouble. Get a job. Maybe get married.
I have been. Occasionally.
Your way doesn't seem to be going too well. Why don't you try the other?
Thanks. Maybe I will.
It's a tender scene, and I want you to remember this as Barbara's interaction with the corrections side of the machine is oddly the only place she finds kindness. Yeah, it's ironic. Barbara returns to prostitution and begins working for thief Emmett Perkins by luring men to his gambling parlor. The machine shows up again with an undercover cop played by Lou Gallo posing as a barfly, who will happily cash Barbara's bad check. A kindly bartender, played by Wesley Lau, purposely spills a drink, foiling the transaction, and whispers to Barbara,
"Cop."
"What?"
"Vice cop."
The The bartender is named Henry Graham, known as Hank, who marries Barbara. Barbara manages to earn a significant amount of money and quits working for Emmett, who is disappointed or relieved. Director Wise cuts to Emmett toppling a house of cards he was building. A clumsy metaphor, and one I wouldn't have attempted as a kid movie maker with my Super 8 camera. Barbara marries Hank, the bartender, her third husband. The couple have a son, Bobby, but their marriage is in turmoil because of Hank's heroin addiction and physical abuse. Barbara leaves Hank and is evicted from her apartment. She must leave her son, Bobby, with her mother. Barbara returns to working for Emmett, who is now associated with thugs John Santo and Bruce King. Police bust the operation, and Barbara surrenders. During the interrogation, she is stunned when authorities accuse her of helping the thugs murder Mabel Monahan, an elderly Burbank woman, for her money.
$251 worth of bad checks, parolee consorting with known criminals, suspicion of robbery.
And, of course, that other thing.
What other thing?
Mrs. Mabel Monahan.
Ha! I never even knew the dame.
You know she's been murdered, don't you?
Yeah, so was Julius Caesar. I didn't know him either.
Barbara is offered a plea deal. Rat and get immunity from prosecution. Barbara declines. Why? Well, it's that defiance streak I was speaking about. You may call it stupid. I call it a veiled rage against the machine. Barbara insists she was at home with Hank and her son, but can't corroborate it. She's indicted by a grand jury. Barbara's childhood friend, Peg, played by Virginia Vincent, visits her in jail and agrees to help care for her baby boy, Bobby.
What about a lawyer? Have you got one?
Nothing to worry about. I'll use the public defender. No, sir. No court-appointed attorney for me. I don't want you, Mr. Tipro, period. I want the public defender.
I assure you I'll do the very best I can with the $500 given me to investigate your case.
$500? That's not enough to investigate who's pinching soap from our why.
A not-so-sharp attorney, Richard Tibro, played by Gage Clark, is assigned to Barbara's case and informs her that her alibi is meaningless unless Hank can corroborate it. Hank split and is somewhere living inside heroin hell. The machine returns again, setting Barbara up with a phony alibi from Ben Miranda, supposedly a friend of a fellow prisoner. At trial, it's revealed Ben is a police officer who recorded her confession with a hidden microphone during their meeting. Barbara insists that she sought the false alibi only to avoid the death penalty and that her admission is false. She's ultimately convicted along with the thugs, and all three are sentenced to death. By this point, you should conclude the machine is obsessed with busting women, getting by as prostitutes, bad check passers, and otherwise low-hanging fruit in the form of sexy female criminals, which make headlines. Headlines mean the sales of newspapers and good public PR for the police. Attorney Tibro cowardly withdraws from Barbara's case and is replaced by attorney Al Matthews, played by Joe DeSantis. In prison, Barbara is relentlessly defiant, refusing to wear her uniform and demanding a radio.
Good night, Barb. Oh, no, I'm sorry. You can't wear that here.
Why not?
It's too provocative.
Provocative?
There's nothing but dames here, not a man within miles. And I've got these for a chastity belt. Oh boy, would I love to have somebody to provoke. You're very foolish to make trouble on your first night, Barbara. I'd advise you to wear the nightgown we've provided you.
As I said, she finds some semblance of compassion, and the authorities concede to her demands. Attorney Matthews has psychologist Dr. Carl Palmberg, played by Theodore Bickel, with a slight accent, evaluate Barbara. After visiting with her, Carl states that while Barbara appears to be amoral, she is averse to violence. He also observes that she is left-handed, and the murder was committed by a right-handed person. Sound like thorough detective work, listeners? Unfortunately for Barbara, Carl dies from a heart attack, and his notes about Barbara cannot be found. I want to point out that Dr. Palmberg resembles Dr. Richman, who diagnosed Norman with a split personality in the 1960 Hitchcock Psycho. Richman was a great performance by Simon Oakland, showing psychiatric proficiency and a curious fascination with Norman's split personality. Simon Oakland's journalist, Ed Montgomery, ain't Dr. Richman, but Theodore Bekel's Dr. Palmberg resembles Richman. I wonder if Bickel's Dr. Palmer in 1958 was inspiration for Simon Oakland's Dr. Richman in 1960. Eerily similar, folks, and remember, nothing happens in film by accident. The media component of the machine makes a grand entrance with journalist Edward Montgomery, played by Simon Oakland, who has covered Barbara's case all along, first as a murderess, but now questions her conviction and publishes a sympathetic series of articles describing her troubled life. Oakland wears a prop in one ear resembling a hearing aid. Perhaps it's a metaphor suggesting what this journalist wants to hear or not, depending upon public sympathies and newspaper sales.
It's Mrs. Graham's tough luck to be young, attractive, belligerent, immoral, and guilty as hell.
Nothing happens in film by accident. The machine grinds along, shredding Barbara and her attorney with a series of start-stop appeals and stays, which all fail, torturing Barbara. You can feel her stress. Her life is on the line. The day before her execution, a demoralized Barbara is transferred to San Quentin Prison, where she meets with a priest, Father Devers, played by John Marley, who was the movie mogul in The Godfather. No horse's head in the bed of this priest, who is kind, decent, and understanding.
I don't know why I should feel so upset. I'm not afraid to die.
Of course not.
You know, I think it'd be rather nice to come face to face with the one person in all the world who knows I'm innocent.
None of us are wholly innocent or guilty in the eyes of God.
I meant Mrs. Monahan.
I brought you this, Barbara.
Thank you, Father. What a lovely going-away present.
St. Jude, saint of the impossible.
Barbara is angered to hear that multiple couples are seeking to adopt her son. It's brutal to watch. She stays awake all night speaking with a kind prison nurse who sits outside her cell. They share the same name and become friends. Alice Backus plays Barbara, the nurse. A small but heartfelt role.
Look, you don't have to stay up all night yakking with me. Tell Fat Stuff to relieve you if you want. No, it's all right.
Music All Night continues after the late news.
Off he
goes. The head basketball coach of Hampton High surrendered to police today on a morals charge.
There, leave that. There's lots of long hair music I like.
Me too.
Sometimes I find it very relaxing.
You got any kids?
Two boys, 3 and 6.
What kind of a guy is your husband?
All right, now I'm serving him with divorce papers for desertion.
Barbara feels Barbara's pain in each stay of execution, just minutes before the sentence is carried out. She's the only female friend, I believe, Barbara Graham had in the entire film. A lovely performance. It's ironic to me Barbara only finds decency and kindness behind bars, although she sits inside the belly of the machine. Barbara is introduced to the prison warden, played by Raymond Bailey, Mr. Drysdale in the Beverly Hillbillies, and delivers a professional and compassionate performance of a warden who is just doing his job, but would rather not be doing his job.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, I understand. We'll make it 10:45. I'm sorry, Barbara. Your writ has been denied. The stay is vacated.
Do I have time to dress?
15 minutes.
Unbeknownst to Barbara, the execution chamber is draped and only feet from Barbara's cell. We have an up-close and uncomfortable seat watching the guards prepare the lethal gas which will kill Barbara. They do their job with professionalism, but take no pleasure in their work, including preparation of the cyanide pellets and sulfuric acid, which will melt them into a deadly gas filling the chamber. The film was shot outside the gates of San Quentin, but the execution chamber is so realistic, I'd swear San Quentin gave the filmmakers access. It's apparent the filmmakers received instruction on protocol and procedures from San Quentin. The machine continues to torture Barbara. 45 minutes before Barbara's scheduled execution, the California governor declares a stay, but her attorney, Al's writ, is invalidated, and the execution is ordered to proceed. Barbara is taken to the gas chamber, but the execution is again halted when Al's amended writ is reviewed. Imagine the torture Barbara is enduring. Director Weiss's use of cuts back and forth to a clock on the wall adds to the tension. Barbara and the prison staff wait several minutes for a response to Al's writ. They are informed it has been rejected and that Barbara's execution is to proceed immediately. Before entering the gas chamber, Barbara demands a mask.
A mask?
I don't want to look at people. I don't want to see them staring at me. I have one. My sleep mask.
She remains defiant to the end, but gifting the toy tiger to somebody on the execution team, a strong metaphor for her giving up. Although dressed for an evening out, she is strapped to the chair with a stethoscope monitoring her heart and lungs. Media maniacs peer through the execution chamber windows as if watching a peep show. It's the machine at its finest, a metaphor, I contend. Dabs Greer plays the San Quentin captain. You'll recognize his face. Long TV and filmography, who compassionately tells Barbara,
"When you hear the pellets drop, count 10. Take a deep breath. It's easier that way."
How do you know?
Barbara is executed with little struggle, defiant to the end. After Barbara is pronounced dead, a despondent Edward Montgomery leaves the prison. I assume he's more upset about losing a profitable story for his paper. On his way out, he is met by Al, who gives him a note from Barbara thanking him.
"Dear Mr. Montgomery, there isn't much I can say with words. They always fail me when most needed. But please know that with all my heart, I appreciate everything you've done for me. Sincerely, Barbara."
It's a classy move on departed Barbara's part, but the note should have said, "Screw you." At the conclusion of the movie, outside the gates of San Quentin, life moves forward with cars honking and people going about their business. The media member of our machine must make a final bow. The movie closes with another disclaimer before credits roll.
"You have just seen a factual story. It is based on articles I wrote, other newspaper and magazine articles, court records, legal and private correspondence, investigative reports, personal interviews, and the letter of Barbara Graham, signed Edgar S. Montgomery, Pulitzer Prize winner, San Francisco Examiner."
Was Barbara guilty or innocent? Graham's guilt or innocence is irrelevant. The real crime was committed by a justice system that framed her, and a media that abetted the effort. I called it the machine, which is more menacing today. Whether innocent or complicit in the murder is up to you to decide. Know this, Barbara didn't stand a chance against the machine. I hope you remember this movie and podcast as you watch true crime programming or ingest sensational news. Think about what you see and hear critically. One day, we all may be at the mercy of the machine. A good period movie and bookend for I Want to Live is the 1956 Hitchcock-directed The Wrong Man, starring Henry Fonda. A saxophone player on his way home is picked up by the police, booked, and tried for a robbery. Until I see you next time, please leave behind a soft footprint, and class is dismissed.
It's also worth noting that while Susan Hayward won the Best Actress Oscar for her portrayal of Barbara Graham, the musical score by Johnny Mandel didn't even get a nomination. But the jazz score was so effective, by the following year, countless movies were utilizing the likes of Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and other legends of jazz in their musical scores. All the more reason to check out this 1959 film. You've been listening to the Razor's Ink podcast with Jonathan Farini. Be sure to check out Jonathan's collection of fiction at the Jonathan B. Farini Story Collection at jonathanfarini.com. Also, look for one of Jonathan's short stories, The Note Inside the Nook, recently published by the Wise Owl Literary Magazine, in which a love story is improbably discovered. That's jonathanfarini.com, or drop an email to razorsincpodcast@gmail.com.